Shalom, shalom. Be shalom, shalom. Be shalom, shalom. Be shalom, shalom. Be shalom, shalom.
We believe in
shalom, shalom.
We believe in peace.
Good evening, friends, fans, and colleagues. This is Karen Tate, your hostess of night. So, you know, it must be VSF time. I want to say thank you to Emma's Revolution. It was their music, Peace, Shalom, Shalom, opening up the show tonight because we never can get enough of that, right? Tonight I have another contributor to Awaken the Feminine, the third anthology, curated by yours truly with us. Our topic is, are shouting in silence our only two options, bringing bipartisanship and transformation to citizen activism. And with me is Sam Daly Harris, whose essay in the anthology is Finding the Sacred and Profound in Lobbying Congress. Sam, an activist for 40 years, founded the Anti-Poverty Lobby Results in 1980. He co-founded the Microcredit Summit campaign in 1995 with Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus and FINCA founder John Hatch. And he also founded Civic Courage in 2012. In fact, he's also an author, and his book is Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government, about which former President Jimmy Carter said, Sam provides a roadmap for global involvement in planning a better future. So it is my great pleasure to have him with us tonight and also to have him as a contributor to the anthology Awaken the Feminine. So, Sam, welcome back to Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you. I do want to say before we start the show, for my regular listeners, you already know, I moved about a month ago, and I'm in a still working out my internet problems. So you may hear during the course of our interview a couple little glitches, but if I can just beg your patience, it all will be resolved in the coming weeks. And if our signal drops out for a second or two, it will come right back. And if we think you possibly have not heard what we said, we will repeat it. And again, I beg your patience, and this will be resolved shortly. I don't expect with this for an indefinite period of time. So, Sam, let's start by having you tell us about your chapter in Awaken the Feminine.
Okay, great. I'd love to do that. And I may just read a little excerpt from it, but the title is Finding the Sacred and Profound in Lobbying Congress. And I think that for most people, that doesn't make any sense, lobbying Congress, sacred and profound. And yet, you know, it's really one of the possibilities before us. And this little story, and I'm going to read a little excerpt from it. It's a marvelous woman, Ellie Sparks is her name. At the time that she's speaking, she was living in Richmond, Virginia, and her congressman was House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. This is about 6 years ago. And her newspaper was the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And she said that when she joined this advocacy group called, in this case, Citizens Climate Lobby, she was suffering from climate trauma. She would read Bill McKibben's book, Earth, and she would weep at home, and she would weep at work. And then she joins this organization. And 18 months later, she meets with 20 congressional district offices, and her experience flips to sacred and profound. And so let me read just a little and give people a flavor. Quote, our director, Mark Reynolds, likes to say we're betting the farm on relationships. Then he tells us we need to build relationships with members of Congress and editorial writers. Most of us volunteers have never done that before. What in the world does a relationship with a member of Congress look like? How do we connect with an editorial page editor? Some of us have found models for those relationships in other parts of our lives. Gary in Boston uses the model of a work relationship. Now, this is where she gets wild and marvelous. My relationship model is different. I adore romantic relationships, so I use romance as my model. That first meeting with an editorial writer, it's like a blind date, only you've decided beforehand you're going to marry this fellow. You're going to be sweet and interesting, not too intense. If it doesn't work out with the editor, you're going to marry one of his friends at the newspaper, the business editor, environment writer, city editor. Someone at this paper will find you interesting and compelling. It's just a matter of being persistent until you find the right connection. I'm going to skip a couple of paragraphs and get to the punchline. And she writes, during our conference, I met 20 congressional offices. I met with many folks whose view of the world was very different than mine. Going into their offices was hard. I had to let go of a lot of emotional baggage. I could no longer judge them or hold hostility in my heart towards them. I had to let go of my fear of climate change and my fear that they wouldn't listen to me. I had to center myself in love. Releasing fear and centering in love, this is sacred and profound work. And for me, that that's a very clear example of the divine feminine, and I just love that particular excerpt from the chapter.
I do too, because, you know, Sam, you know, no one gets more upset than me, I guess, and, you know, with everything going on. But even I have come to the point where I realize, you know, yelling and shouting gets us nowhere. You know, I've come a lot more around to the idea that if we can't find common ground, at least, you know, love might be a little bit harder, but maybe common ground is a form of love. You know, there's all sorts of types of love, actually. You know, I think, you know, finding the common ground, a.k.a. love, is how, you know, we're going to fix things, I think, because I think so many of us really do want the same thing, even if we're on opposite sides of the aisle.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. You know, another example from this particular organization, it's one of several that I coached, the Citizens Climate Lobby. At last Congress, they enrolled 45 Republicans and 45 Democrats in the House of Representatives to join the House Climate Solutions Caucus, when 4 years ago you couldn't have gotten one Republican to put their name on anything with the word climate in the title. And so something extraordinary had to happen to cause that kind of change. And when I coach groups about a meeting with a member of Congress, a big part of the coaching is that part where you're really trying to listen. When the member of Congress maybe rejects what you're saying or opposes something that you're proposing, and you go to the level of, could you say more about that? Could you tell me why you think that is? I know it looks like you'll never support this, but what would it take to have you come on board? And in each one of those three cases, you then stop and listen and let them speak out and let them get whatever it is that's inside, to the point where you might, in fact, find the common ground that didn't seem to be there at first.
Yeah. Well, you know, as strange as this may seem, you know who was a good teacher for me? While I was being entertained, I loved the show Madam Secretary. And
right.
I see how she does that week in and week out. She will go to people. fence, so to speak, and she listens for an opening, something that they need or they want, and perhaps it's she can meet them there. And yeah. then that's the beginning. You know, that's the beginning of maybe something small today and maybe something bigger tomorrow.
Right. Well, it's a great model to look at, but then we, as citizens, have to take it off the television and into real life. Maybe I could just tell you for a moment how I ended up doing what I'm doing, because I think it's
Because you started out as a musician, didn't
exactly.
you?
So
tell
us tell
about
my
that.
Story,
you went from...
Exactly. Yeah, I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in music, and I played percussion instruments in the Miami Philharmonic Orchestra for 12 years, and I also taught high school music. And then, 39 years ago, I founded the Anti-Poverty Lobby Results. And a lot of times people are, well, what's the connection, music, poverty lobby? What was the motivation there? And when I look back in my life, there are a couple of experiences that pointed to a new direction. I graduated from high school in 1964, and I played timpani in the orchestra at the ceremony. And just before the ceremony began, a flute player came back to the percussion section and told me that a high school fraternity brother of mine, a year younger, had died the day before in a tractor-trailer accident in Georgia. It was her next-door neighbor, so she knew about it before I did. I always say I was 17. When I was 17, mortality was an irrelevant concept. But during the mourning period and the funeral and after the funeral, I went with my friend's younger brother to pick up his report card from the homeroom teacher. It began to dawn on me that maybe I had 17 more minutes or months or years. And the questions of purpose came up. Why am I here? What am I here to do? What's my purpose? 4 years later, college graduation, 1968 June, Robert Kennedy's assassinated right in those days. And again, it's what is this life? What is this death? Why am I here? What am I here to do? No answers, but the questions are getting clearer. 9 years later, I always say I'm a little slow, I'm invited to a presentation, 1977, on ending world hunger, put on by the Hunger Project. And I go to this thing thinking, well, hunger's inevitable. What do I know? I'm a musician. I mean, it's inevitable because there are no solutions, because if there were solutions, somebody would have done something. But this is what I'm thinking. I go to this thing, and it's obvious right away. There's no mystery to growing food or clean water or basic health. I'm not hopeless about the lack of solutions. I'm hopeless about human nature. People will just never get around to doing the things that can be done. But there's one human nature I have some control over, my own. And my questions, why am I here? What am I here to do? So I get involved in a big way. This is the end of the story. In 1978, 1979, I speak to 7,000 high school students where I live in Miami, Florida, classroom by classroom by classroom. And before I go into the first class, I read statements from the National Academy of Sciences food nutrition study calling for the political will to end hunger. So I asked 7,000 students, what's the name of your member of Congress? I don't want to know if you wrote him. I don't want to know if you met him. Just the name. Out of 7,000 students asked, 200 could answer correctly. That's fewer than 3%. Over 97% couldn't answer. And so results grew out of this gap between the calls for the political will to end hunger on the one hand and the lack of basic information on who represented us in Washington on the other. And so it was quite a journey, but now it looks like all I do is citizen empowerment and political activism, but my start was in music.
So let me ask you this, and I love your story, and it's inspirational. And I know you hear the but coming. For the person that says, I'm taking care of two kids, I'm working two jobs, they don't care about me anyway, they're just in it for the money, they're not public servants anymore, all of that sort of stuff, what do you say?
Well, I mean, here's the thing, let me say it two ways. I will be at a lecture, and someone will come up to me and say, look, I have two kids at home. There's just no way I can really get involved right now. Someone else would get up and come up to me and say, I have two kids at home. I've got to get involved for them. So different people need to do different things for themselves. But, if someone's really got two or three jobs just to put food on the table, I get it. But most people, I mean, we live in a society where binge-watching TV shows is a thing and spending hours on Facebook is a thing. And for a lot of people, I don't have time. It's just I don't have time to do something that I believe won't make a difference. I just don't
yeah.
want to be thwarted that way. And I'm saying, so let me give you another example. One of the groups that Results lobbies on behalf of is the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. It's a global program, and globally, the Global Fund and its partners have saved 27 million lives in the last 17 years since it started. It's a big deal. I mean, my main message is you can make a profound difference on big issues with your voice as a citizen. There's more messages after that. But anyway, President Trump called for a 31% cut to the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria for this year. Results volunteers got 153 Republicans and Democrats to sign one letter to the leaders of a key appropriation subcommittee asking them to protect the Global Fund. And the subcommittee and the full committee agreed. Now, frankly, it's one of those, in the government shutdown, it's one of those six departments that's not been finalized and not been fully funded yet. So we don't know the answer. But what I'm saying is, once this government opens up again, it's very, very likely that the president's 31% cut will be a 0% cut because citizens,
gotcha.
They said, they don't listen to me. Well, no, I'm going to give it a shot and see if they will listen to me, rather than giving
right.
up, jumping in.
Well, I remember when George Bush, Jr. Was talking about slashing Social Security, and the congressional or the White House switchboard got shut down. So many calls came in, and he suddenly stopped talking about that. So,
exactly.
Our voices do matter.
Yeah.
Well, the title of your lecture is "Are Shouting in Silence the Only Two Options? Bringing Bipartisanship and Transformation to Citizen Activism." Are you rejecting the resistance movement, saying that it's the wrong way to go?
Well, here's the thing. I've actually done this talk four times in the last week and all over the place, and I always say at the beginning of the talk, advocacy is on a spectrum, and I'm going to talk about one point on the spectrum. It's not better than other points on the spectrum or worse. It's just another point. So the work that I do, and I'm talking here about bipartisanship and transformation, is not resistance. That's another point on the spectrum. It's not a better point or a worse point. In fact, without the resistance movement, Obamacare would probably be gone, but because people spoke up, it was protected. So I'm not rejecting the resistance movement. I'm not saying it's the wrong way to go. That's not true. It's just not my way. The resistance movement has, at some level, at its core, anger about wrongheaded decisions and et cetera, et cetera. And I just wouldn't have lasted 39 years with anger as the motivator.
I totally get that. Yeah, you burn out, you know.
Exactly.
So I have to ask, what are your thoughts on the effectiveness of the women's marches? You know, we just had the third one, I think, this past weekend, you know, in response to Trump being in office. You know, any thoughts? I mean, do you...
What's the thing? You know, whether it's the women's march or whether it's the big climate march a year or so ago, the issue is not there's anything wrong with the march. No, it's great. But we got to keep marching into our member of Congress's office. We can't say that, well, I marched a year and a half ago, or in this case, a week ago. I'm done. No, it's kind of more like the beginning. So I celebrate the marches. I then urge people to keep going and not stop and wait for the next march.
Yeah, it's almost as if you have to, you know, be in their face, you know, like with the sit-ins outside their office and stuff like that. You know, I'm thinking about the people who went up to some of Trump's cabinet in restaurants and made sure they knew the effect of things that they were doing or didn't do. You know.
Right. Well, see, let me just, if I could, I alluded to the main messages from my talk, and I want to just go through all three. One is, you can make a profound difference on big issues with your voice as a citizen. The second message is, you probably haven't, because of your sense of powerlessness and resignation about politics, especially federal politics. And message three is, if you connect with an organization that's committed to dissolving the powerlessness, you can make a profound difference on big issues with your voice as a citizen. And confronting people in restaurants is fine. I mean, it's not my style. It's another piece of the resistance. It's fine. It's just not going to probably add up to a profound difference on big issues with my voice as a citizen. That's a longer-term strategy, and it's also
coming from anger too, you know.
If I can interrupt and just say, if I say I'm coming from love, that doesn't mean that I go into a congressman's office and I'm automatically filled with love. No, as she said in that little excerpt, releasing fear and centering myself in love, you know, you have to work at it in a way. I mean, I do anyway. You know, one of the key parts of meeting a member of Congress is to find something to thank them for, to find something to be appreciative of. I was leading a workshop last June and on another group on overturning Citizens United and getting money out of politics. Woman raises her hand, she says, "Oh, you don't know my member of Congress. You want us to find something to thank them for. You obviously don't know my member of Congress." And I said, that's why this is a spiritual practice. You have to go deeper and find something. You know, you have to do some more research. So it's not like the love version is a slam dunk easy all the time, because you might have a member of Congress that's done a bunch of wacko things, and you know, finding something to appreciate in them, it could be a challenge.
Right.
So.
You like to share quotes that you describe as laying out our predicament, pointing to what keeps us stuck.
Yes.
Did you want to share a couple of those and tell us?
I love these, yes. This first one is from Francis Moore LePay, who wrote Diet for a Small Planet 40 years ago. But in a more recent book called Getting a Grip 2, she wrote, "Our real problem is not a heating planet or rampant malnutrition. We only have one real problem, our own feelings of powerlessness to manifest the solutions right in front of our noses." And so I love that line. We only have one real problem, our own feelings of powerlessness to manifest the solutions right in front of our noses. I kind of feel like it's liberating when we get to let the ugliness out. Let me do this other one. This is from Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, who works on getting money out of politics. He said, "We did a poll and found that 96% of Americans believe it important to reduce the influence of money in politics." Isn't that great if that was the end of the quote, but it's not. He said, "We found that 96% of Americans believe it important to reduce the influence of money in politics, but 91% don't think it's possible." That's the politics of resignation. But the politics of resignation gives you a perfect strategy for winning. How do we thaw that resignation? Because once we do, I think we have a real chance of winning. Well, the groups that I coach create structures of support that are geared to thawing the resignation. And so I'm going to finish with this one quick story of a group that's not up for thawing the resignation. I was meeting with the head of a really big group. You would know them really well. Your listeners would know them really well. He was the head of organizing. And he said to me, "We can't let our volunteers write letters to the editor or op-eds because they'll get it wrong and misrepresent the organization." Well, so much for powerlessness. But one of the groups I coach, Citizens Climate Lobby, their volunteers had 4,200 letters, op-eds, and editorials published in 2017. So one group saying they'll get it wrong and misrepresent the organization. The other one saying, "What do we got to do to help them get it right and then give that to them?" And as a result, they end up with 4,200 letters, op-eds, and editorials. I call the other group advocacy malpractice, that if you really want to get involved, you could very easily volunteer with a group that practices advocacy malpractice. And, you know, that's what something I like to help people guard against.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could, you know, if you really wanted to, it would be easy enough to provide talking points, you know.
Yeah.
Now you founded the Anti-Poverty Lobby Results 40 years ago. What kind of progress has Results made using the bipartisan approach, and or you find that you can still make it work now?
Yes. Well, let me give you this example. And so my first message is you can make a profound difference on big issues with your voice as a citizen. When Results started to lobby in the early 1980s on child survival issues, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, was reporting that 41,000 children around the world were dying every day from largely preventable, underlying preventable things like measles coupled with malnutrition or dehydration brought on by dirty water or not washing hands and whatever. And so Results played a really key role as in advocacy on that reduction in child deaths from 41,000 a day in the early 80s to 15,300 a day. And in the New York Times 6 years ago, the former head of deputy head of UNICEF, Kuul Gautam, said, quote, "To a great extent, it was because of the receptivity created by Results that the U.S. funding for child survival increased so dramatically, and that led many other countries to come on board." So I'm just trying to say, it was volunteers who got educated with the help of the organization, who met with their members of Congress, generated media, that really began that increase in funding for simple things that could save kids' lives, so that it dropped from 41,000 a day to 15,300. And that's one example of profound difference on a big issue with your voice as a citizen.
Yeah. Just, you know, on a side note here, talking about that success and, you know, the fact that it, you know, affected children and health, it made me think about what's happening with the water in Flint. And it's amazing to me that nothing's been done in Flint. I guess I wonder, do you have any insight on where things are down there? I mean, is there hope for I mean, I know this is kind of throwing you a curveball.
Let me give you a quote from years ago from the head of UNICEF, the late Jim Grant, and I kind of tie it back to Flint. He said, each of the great social achievements of recent decades has come about, now social achievements like the civil rights movement, the women's vote. He said, each of the great social achievements of recent decades have come about not because of government proclamations, but because people organized, made demands, and made it good politics for governments to respond. It's the political will of the people that makes and sustains the political will of government, end of quote. And I always say, well, if the political will of the people is a bit asleep at the wheel, then the political will of government will be a bit asleep at the wheel. And so, if we're going to sit back and wait for the governor to do something, or sit back and wait for the mayor or county commissioner to do something, it's mostly not how it works. It's the political will of the people that makes and sustains the political will of governments, or as the head of Citizens Climate Lobby says, members of Congress don't create political will. They respond to it. And who creates it is us. And, of course, we may not. Well, you know, I think it's 90 million Americans didn't vote 2 years ago when President Trump was elected. 90 million. Yeah, we're not all that we could be as citizens.
Well, I hear you, and I agree. I mean, you know, too many of us are, like you said, we're sort of resigned, and we sit on the couch and we entertain ourselves rather than being good, you know, citizens, and, you know, getting out there and doing what we can, or joining a group that can, you know, make a difference, that sort of thing. I wonder if, you know, I guess this might sound pessimistic or paranoid, but do you think it's the government kind of just ignoring the will of the people? Because it seems like the will of the people kind of just swirls down the drain.
Yeah, I mean, well, let me see. I missed a little, but I think I got the bulk of your question. And it seems a little like a lot of times I'm asked, well, do online petitions matter? I mean, does it make a difference if I sign that petition on my computer? And Paul Loeb, who wrote Soul of a Citizen, once said to me, you know, those petitions sent to Congress, they're counted, but they're also discounted. And they know how little effort it took to do that, and how it could be easily ignored because the sender is probably off on something else. But when we write a letter in Results or Citizens Climate Lobby, or I coach the Quaker Lobby, FCNL, Friends Committee on National Legislation, it's kind of like we send our letter with our hand cupped to our ear, waiting for the response. And if we don't hear the response, we reach out. I just did a presentation. I did a talk and Q&A on Saturday for about an hour, and we had a break. And then after that little break, I led the group. This was on a retirement community in northern Florida, Penny Retirement Community. And I coached them through writing a letter to their member of Congress, Republican Congressman Ted Yoho. I took home 22 letters with me, and I mailed them to one of our staff in Washington who will hand deliver them, because it takes weeks for a letter to get through to Congress these days, for fear of what might be put in the letter in terms of poison.
Yeah, anthrax or something.
Anthrax,
yeah.
And such. Yeah. And so, but the letter they wrote was asking for a meeting to meet with them to discuss the issue they wanted to discuss, not write a letter and done. No, write a letter and follow up and schedule an appointment to really take
right.
it to another level.
Well, maybe what I maybe my question the signal dropped out and you didn't actually hear it. So let me just say again: has it always been this way, or do you think it's worse now in terms of if the will of the people is really ignored? Because that's what it feels like. I think, you know. I mean, you look at all the progressive things that most people want,
yes.
And, you know, it's just, you know, and people don't even know their progressive ideas. But you know, our people in Congress, because they're bought and paid for by corporations,
right.
you know, they can ignore it.
Well, they can, so long as we're letting them ignore it. Or said another way.
Okay.
If so-and-so is our member of Congress and gives them a bundle to put wacky ads on TV to get reelected 6 weeks before the election, and we let that run the show, then yeah, it'll work that way. But if we're awake to what they're not doing or what they should have done or whatever, it almost doesn't matter how much money they get to put nonsense ads up, because we're paying attention and know that that's baloney. And that's why...
And we're
going
to hold their feet
to
the fire.
Yeah. And one of the groups I coach is called American Promise. And their focus, they're not old. I mean, they're like 3 years old as an organization and a year and a half with their grassroots groups. I think they had 17 meetings with their member of Congress in 2017, and then their second year, they had 137 meetings. I mean, that's,
wow.
that kind of growth. And their focus is overturning Citizens United, that Supreme Court decision that said, corporations are people and money is speech, and you can't deny speech, so unlimited money is fine. And so they're working
right.
really hard to turn that around. And
that's really important.
Yeah.
So let me ask you something else. In your book, Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government, you share a prayer that the results group in Atlanta used to shift negative
right.
attitudes about their member of Congress, and that resulted in a transformation. Why don't you tell listeners, or maybe even share the prayer with us?
I will.
Might be inspirational.
Okay, great. I will, and I am finding it right now, and I found it. And so let me tell this story. It's from some years ago, and it was in Atlanta, Georgia. And the congressman, the late Pat Swindoll, was one of very few who had voted against famine aid for starving Ethiopians. And the guy who's talking about this, he says, you know, it's like if you're watching a sports team that's terrible. You're sitting in the stands with bags over your heads because you're so ashamed to be rooting for such losers. And he says, if politics were a sport and we were sitting in the stands watching our congressmen playing on the field, we would be wearing those bags over our heads over the shame we felt for having him as a representative. Our thoughts and discussions about him were very negative, and we pretty much wrote him off, figuring our best chance was that maybe he would be defeated in 2 years. But at Sam's suggestion, we began to shift our thinking on our congressman. There was this prayer that a volunteer in Houston, Newton Hightower, had written for his member of Congress, someone he had similar difficulties 2 years earlier. We adapted it to our congressman, and we added Congressman Swindoll's name, and it went like this. And here's the prayer. Thank you, God, for Pat Swindoll. This is the guy who wrote it against famine aid for starving Ethiopians. Thank you, God, for Pat Swindoll. We know he's a good man who wants to do right in the world. We know he struggles with the same problems we do, closing our hearts to those who don't agree with us. There are no thoughts or feelings that he's had that we haven't had, and vice versa. We pray for all of us to learn compassion for people in our country and far away, for rich and poor. We pray that Pat and we will be less frightened of each other. We pray our focus will be more to love and appreciate him and less to change him. Help us remember that sharing love with the world is the highest contribution we can make and will lead to children being fed and the planet surviving. Forgive our righteousness and anger. Open our hearts and minds to find the next expression of love for Pat that he can receive. End of quote. And Steve was talking about that prayer, and he said, you know, we would read that prayer at our meeting, and we'd go, yeah, right. And then we'd read it the next time, and we'd go, yeah, fat chance. And then we'd read it the next time, and after a while, it finally started to sink in. And they would meet with their congressman at, he used to call it Chat with Pat Sessions, the congressman. They renamed it Spat with Pat because every time they met with him, somebody had a bone to pick with the congressman and got in some kind of argument. But they'd come with a handshake and a smile and tell him some new information about a program that made a difference empowering the poor. And 2 years later, they go to his office, they bring a TV and VCR to show him a segment on the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. The congressman is sitting with his desk with his chin under his knees watching the video, and they ask him if he'll co-sponsor this micro-enterprise legislation, and he says, I'd be happy to. He says, I have a column. Do you think you could write something for my column in the newspaper so we can educate the public? And, you know, and Steve says, all of a sudden I was ghostwriting for a congressman who 2 years earlier had voted against famine aid for starving Ethiopians. I think we were the only group in Georgia who could get liberal Congressman John Lewis and conservative Congressman Pat Swindoll on the same bill. And I don't think I can find it fast enough. You know, it's really great, he said, to see people as possibilities rather than as obstacles. And
wow.
What
a great story.
Yeah, it's really fun.
I was hearing you, it felt like a tenacious love.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah, tenacious love. Well, you know, after your time with Results, the first group you coached was Citizens Climate Lobby. You know, we've certainly been inundated with bad news on climate from President Trump. The Citizens Climate Lobby, are they taking the bipartisan route, and are they having any progress?
Yeah, they are. You know, it's almost like they had a two-part strategy in a way. You could say a kiddie pool strategy and then a dive in the deep end strategy. And in some sense, and I don't want to belittle it, their kiddie pool strategy was at House Climate Solutions Caucus. And when President Trump was elected, there had been 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats on that brand new Climate Solutions Caucus. But back then, 4 Republicans had either lost their seats or retired, and it was down to 6 and 6. After the president was elected, they enrolled 39 more Republicans and 39 more Democrats for a total of 45 and 45 on the Climate Solutions Caucus. So there was these people who got to get in the kiddie pool and see it wasn't so terrible. And then the real work is their legislation. It was introduced last Congress at the end, and I think it'll be introduced, I think, any day now. And what it's called is a carbon fee and dividend, which is a steadily rising fee or tax on carbon, fully refunded to the public. So I go to the gas station, and I see that the cost of my gas is going up, but I get a rebate or a dividend or a refund of this tax. I see that my heating bill is going up, but I'm also getting this check, this dividend, that the tax is going nowhere but back to the public, so that I can maybe get a more fuel-efficient car, or maybe I can do something about improving the efficiency of my house and having it like leak less hot air or cold air, or maybe even at some point solar panels on my car. So that was introduced by, I think it was 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans, that kind of bill that's frankly calling for a tax, but the tax is fully refunded to the public. I mean, you saw the riots in France a couple of weeks ago. That was partially because of a gas tax, but then the money didn't go back to the public in that case, which is why they have this other strategy.
I'm happy to just hear that Republicans are getting on board for anything related to climate. I mean, you know,
well, the top one isn't, but a lot of others are. Yeah, the top one isn't yet, but a lot of the others are, and that's really the way you need to work it right now.
Well, now you're also working with the Quaker Lobby Friends Committee on National Legislation in their campaign to prevent nuclear war with North Korea, and with
yes.
American Promise and their work to overturn Citizens United. You mentioned them a little bit. Tell us about that work or any other groups you think listeners might want to hear that good things are really happening.
If I could just start with this, you know, if people are interested in the global or domestic poverty, they can go check out results.org. If they're instead interested more in climate change, they could go to citizensclimatelobby.org. And then the two you just mentioned, one is the Quaker Lobby, fcnl.org, Friends Committee on National Legislation, fcnl.org. And, you know, frankly, they change their issue every year. So last year, they were focused on preventing nuclear war with North Korea. This year, they're focused on repealing the authorization for the use of military force, or AUMF. Just after 9/11, Congress authorized the use of military force in 2001, and they never repealed it. So President Bush and President Obama and President Trump can go all over the place using military force under this, well, what would it be, 18-year-old authorization for the use of military force from Congress called an AUMF. And so they're working to repeal that, saying, no, Congress can authorize the use of military force again if it needs to or wants to, but it shouldn't have this open-ended authorization from 18 years ago that any president uses any time. So that's what they're working
on. That's dangerous.
I coached them 2 years, and in 3 years they had 92 chapters all around the United States. And you can go to fcnl.org, N for Nancy, or national. And then American Promise is even younger with their grassroots groups. And they had their first legislation introduced a few days ago on overturning Citizens United with a Democrat and Republican lead sponsor. That's the difference. Like last year, they had 170 co-sponsors on a bill, and only one was a Republican, and most Republicans didn't consider him a Republican. And this time, they have a bill that's introduced by a Democrat and Republican, and so it's and again, In all of these cases, these groups have a nationwide telephone conference call or webinar every month with guest speakers and Q&A. They'll maybe have some training on the call. They'll have an action sheet and an action every month. They hold your hand, really, and really help people move from kindergarten to first, third, fifth, ninth, 12th grade and beyond as a citizen and activist.
And you know, people can take what they learn from being a part of this group and do something themselves or,
take
that knowledge to take that knowledge to another group.
Absolutely.
So I'll just mention those again. If people want to Google them, they're easy enough to find. There's Results to End Global and Domestic Poverty. There's Citizens Climate Lobby working on reversing climate change. There's American Promise working on overturning Citizens United, and the FCNL. They were working on preventing war with North Korea, but now they're working on,
repealing preventing the authorization. You want
to
repeal this
to make it so the
AUMF.
President.
Exactly.
Well, Sam, we've come, to about the end of our time here, but this has really been great to hear you regale me and listeners with the way things can end. Positive response that can still happen in spite of the administration we have, maybe in spite of what our attitude has been about, the government failing us. I think we just have to, make a commitment. We want good things to happen. We can't expect we can't just leave it to somebody else to always do. We just have to find something we feel passionate about and get in there and get our hands dirty.
We don't have to do it alone.
Because that's when we feel helpless. When we feel disempowered. That's doing something, that's making progress. Then I think that totally shifts our attitude.
Exactly. Do we have time for me to share the quote that I always share at the end of my talks?
We certainly do. I'd be glad to hear it, as I'm sure listeners would.
This is from George Bernard Shaw's Man and Superman. This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose, recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being a force of nature, instead of a selfish, feverish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I've got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. End of quote. I love that quote so much.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And, in that, I think it's a reflection of the sacred feminine, too, as is being in service, And I think that's an important value or quality that we don't hear enough about, the importance of being in service and how that can fill us up. I think really make a difference in how we feel about ourselves as well as, how it can also impact others. So, well, Sam, I want to thank you for the work you're doing out there in the world. I want to thank you for taking time to be in my anthology and coming on my radio show the times you have. The fact that, we can connect the dots. and the sacred feminine, because I think so often when people hear sacred feminine, they think about archetypes, they maybe think about deity, but they don't connect the dots with the values that help us reconcile our spirituality and our politics. And that's why I wanted you to be in the anthology, because I felt you were helping people connect the dots between spirituality and politics.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all that you do.
Thank you, Sam. And I'm sure we'll be in touch. And, you know, please, as you can, let people know about the anthology, Awaken the Feminine. We'd all appreciate our wisdom being, you know, reaching, you know, new corners of the globe.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed hearing our guest, Daly Harris tonight, and with that important message. And before you go, there's another message I'd like you to hear, and this is from Joe Carson. So please hang in there with me just a little bit more.
Hello. Let me say a few things about Joe Carson's film, Dancing with Gaia, an exploration of Earth-based spirituality shot at sacred sites around the world. Here is what Drusilla Pettibone said on DearMist.com. I was truly touched and even awed by the film. I don't think I can comment on it adequately until I've had a chance to watch it a couple more times. I really appreciate that there is so much substantive information to digest. For example, the info about hinges and tracing the horizon line is all new to me and totally fascinating. The film was obviously very beautiful, and I was amazed how it was able to capture so many of the descriptions visually and seamlessly connect vintage footage with modern. I especially loved when images were dynamically superimposed on each other, like the lace with the water, and the dancing in the flowering meadow. A visual feast, and with so many layers. I am also so pleased to have been introduced to Monica Shu and her work. It's so important for pagans to become aware of our heritage. It seems easily lost among so many new books, and the film really brought me home in a new way. Dancing with Gaia is available at dancingwithgaia.com.
You've been listening to one of the trailers for Dancing with Gaia. The DVD comes packaged with a 45-page color mini book, which goes even deeper into the material. You can buy the DVD and booklet for only $20 at dancingwithgaia.com. I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning in tonight, and especially for their patience, you know, with the sound glitches that we will soon have remedied. Me, Gypsy Jean. She has just created a brick and mortar goddess temple in Utah, and you will want to hear that story. It is pretty fantastic. Yes, we do have a goddess temple in Utah. Well, that about does it for me tonight, dear listeners. Thank you for your input. Thank you for your emails. Thank you for your listener loyalty. It is all gas in my tank and has kept me doing Voices of the Sacred Feminine for more than 13 years now. Hope you're staying warm wherever you are, and you're enjoying the winter, and you are working out your, you know, your authentic self and who you are going to be in 2019, and we will see the best version of yourself, you know, in this the springtime with the coming of the sun. Well, that about does it for me tonight. I hope you will be back again with me next Wednesday. Until then, may Isis embrace you and